This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, here in the U.S., new daily COVID cases just shy of about 100,000. You know, you might have seen on Twitter that Carol Masser's got it. That's why she's out. My brother's got it. He texted me last night.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, Michael. He also tweeted about it, too.
I missed that tweet, Kitty. I do follow him.
You do follow him, I know. Still, though, it's down 13% over the last 2 weeks. That's according to the New York Times. Should we even be counting COVID cases, especially when so many of the ones that people have aren't reported because, you know, they're taking them with Binax tests at home? Daily average right now, though, 30,000 hospitalizations. That also according to the New York Times. With us now is Dr. Amish Adalja, senior scholar and infectious disease physician at the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, that is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Adalja joining this afternoon on the phone from Pittsburgh. Dr. Adalja, it's been a few months since we spoke. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us again. Should we even be counting cases? Do those numbers even make sense because there are so many home tests?
I don't think that we should be counting cases because, as you said, many of the cases are being diagnosed at home. They're not part of official numbers. And we're at a point now where we've seen a lot of decoupling or delinkage of cases from hospitalization, severe disease, and death, which is exactly where we want it to be. Remember, this is a virus that's never going to be eradicated. It's never going to be eliminated. We're always going to have ups and downs in cases. We're going to have hot spots. We're going to have new variants. The goal has always been to shift the cases to the mild spectrum to make it more like other respiratory viruses. We don't count influenza cases. We count influenza severe disease. And I think that's the paradigm we want to move forward with COVID.
Well, that's sort of what I'm wondering. At what point can we think about this as, you know, something similar to the flu rather than, you know, something as sort of dramatic as it's been thought of over the past 2 years, especially with that decoupling that you're talking about from hospitalizations?
I think that in general in the United States, we can think of it that way, because if you look at the case fatality ratio, meaning what percentage of people die with COVID, it is now approaching seasonal influenza. There's still more people overall, the raw numbers, because more people are getting infected. But on a pound-for-pound basis, because of vaccines, because of monoclonal antibodies, because of antiviral therapy and pre-existing immunity, we do have this largely tamed, and we don't see it threatening hospital capacity any longer. I'm talking to you from a hospital right now. It's not something that is anything like it was in the past. And that's because of all the progress we've made with treating this. So I do think that in the United States, we can think of it in that manner.
Dr. Adalja, one of the reasons that I like speaking to you about this is because you tend to present this in a really realistic way with how people live their lifestyles and approaching it from a harm reduction standpoint, which is a lot of the work that you've done historically, even before the COVID pandemic, was something we were talking about. I'm wondering how we should all be living our lives right now. Because it certainly seems like in some places, you know, masks are still required at physical therapy. For example, this morning, it's a healthcare facility, so I'm required to wear a mask there along with everybody else who's there. But at so many other places, they're not. How should we be living our lives right now?
I think it's not going to be one size fits all. Each person has their own individual risk tolerances and their own individual risks for severe disease. But what I think is important for everyone to understand is that there's really never going to be a time when we're at COVID zero. The post-pandemic world is never going to be 2019. It's always going to be a world in which there's a baseline number of COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. There's no way to get the COVID risk down to zero. You can't magically put it into bats. So people have to learn how to risk calculate, and that may be different for different people, and it should be different for different people. If you're an 80-year-old person, it's going to be very different than if you're an 18-year-old person. That's what we have to allow people to do and teach them how to do that. I think with masks, that's one area where some people feel comfortable wearing a mask. Some people don't want to wear a mask. There's certain venues that want masks, and I think healthcare facilities are a little bit special and probably will continue to have masks, especially with patient contact. Because of the vulnerability of the people in a hospital setting. But in general, I think we have to learn how to acclimatize to it, and each person is going to acclimatize to it differently.
One area where I see the comparison between seasonal influenza and where we are with COVID breakdown is when it comes to long COVID, because you don't really hear about people, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Adalja, you don't really hear about people having long-term effects from the seasonal flu. And one reason why I still try to avoid getting COVID is because I've seen colleagues and friends with long COVID symptoms. What do you say to that?
Well, I think long COVID is one area where we need to know a lot more, be able before we can really say anything definitively. We don't really even agree on the definition. You have to really separate people that are hospitalized, especially those that were in the ICU, from people that just had an uncomplicated outpatient illness. And I think we really need to understand why it occurs and who it occurs in. What we do know is that it's less likely to occur in vaccinated individuals. And I think that's one thing that people can kind of take home about long COVID, and that people get better over time. But when you look at some of the percentages in some of the studies, they say 30% of people or 50% of people have long COVID. Most of those studies don't have control groups. So we don't even have rigorous studies. I think it probably will come down to 5 to 10%, probably closer to 5% when you actually look at rigorous studies, looking at symptoms that actually interfere with people's activities of daily living and subtract out people who are hospitalized, because there's definitely phenomena like post-hospital syndrome,
right,
and post-ICU syndrome that are completely distinct and do occur with any type of hospital admission or any kind of ICU admission. But I think it is one variable, and I think we have to learn more about it, but I don't think it should be something that completely derails
right.
our ability to get back to normal.
Dr. Amish Adalja, senior scholar and infectious disease physician from the Bloomberg School of Public Health. It is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and at Bloomberg Philanthropies.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Gun stocks moving higher in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court decision establishing the right to carry firearms in New York. Well, earlier today, New York City Mayor Eric Adams made a public statement about this Supreme Court decision. Here's a portion of what the mayor had to say.
The opinion claims to be based on nation historical past, but does not account for the reality of today. It ignores the present and it endangers our future.
That was New York City Mayor Eric Adams addressing the media earlier today. We've got a great voice to talk all about this. June Grasso is Bloomberg News legal analyst. She's also the host of Bloomberg Law. It's weeknights at 10 p.m. Wall Street time right here on Bloomberg Radio. June's with us now in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. June, help clear this up for me, because I got to confess I'm a little confused here. We heard from the mayor's chief of police who said that the police commissioner, I should say, who said nothing changes here in New York City. But at the same time, my understanding with this decision is that there is a change and we could go out and get a gun at this point.
Well, you're both right, sort of.
Okay, the liberal arts answer. I like that.
How did you know? The Supreme Court said that New York's law current law is unconstitutional and that people under the Second Amendment have a right to carry a handgun in public. That doesn't mean there can't be laws restricting that right. So even in the concurring opinion, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, joined by the chief, said that you could still have licensing requirements for things like background checks, mental health records checks, training in firearms handling, and in laws regarding the use of force. So the governor said today that she's going to call a special session so that New York, the legislature, can get together and work on a new law. So if this law doesn't work and you can't go out right now and get a firearms permit based on, oh, anyone can get it, but coming up in the future, we'll find out what the next law is. And as the mayor said, you know, they're basing this, they're looking back, they're textualist, they're looking back at, they say, to determine whether a regulation is constitutional, look at the text of the Constitution and the history of our country. That puts a lot of laws in jeopardy, like red flag laws.
Okay.
The so-called boyfriend loophole, they weren't around. So it's there are a lot of questions after this opinion.
So this was a New York law. What are the implications for the rest of the U.S., though? Because, I mean, New York, one of at least six states that had a law like this.
Well, the rest of those laws would be unconstitutional if they were brought before a court, and you've got to believe that they would be. So those states will have to do what New York is going to do, which is try to pass a law that, in other words, those states are may carry states. You're allowed to have shall carry laws, so that have, you know, that don't say, oh, it's, you know, no one can get a gun except for self defense, or you have to protect yourself, you have to show us why. You can't have that, but you can have, as I said, different kinds of restrictions, and the states will have to look at that and pass different kinds of laws, and then we'll go through the whole process. They'll go to court and be challenged, and then we'll see if they pass the rigors.
Help me understand what happens next week if we're sitting here talking about Roe v. Wade essentially being overturned and that being kicked to the states. So we have on the one hand the Supreme Court saying that states do not have a right to make their own gun laws, but on the other hand we're saying next week perhaps that states do have a right to make restrictive abortion laws.
Ironic. It just shows you that textualism, despite the fact that people say this means that everyone will interpret the Constitution based on the text and everyone will be the same, it shows you how things can come out differently based on textualism. Now, with the abortion, which we're expecting that they're going to overrule Roe v. Wade, if they do, the president has said that he's going to try to implement some executive actions, but none of those executive actions can bring back a constitutional right.
But don't you see some tension between these two decisions?
Oh, yes. I do see tension between them. I think that's what I was saying about textualism. It's what we want to do at the moment. So in other words, you can find a different reason for anything, right? You and I could say, oh, it looks very blue outside. And then someone else can say, no, I think it looks grayish, you know, and we can have a whole discussion about it. Well, that's what this is all about. And what people criticize this court for is the fact that they say they're very political and that they look at the outcome that they want and then they read everything to fit that outcome. And I think that's what's happening with abortion. They're saying, okay, the states can do it. Here they're saying, well, the states can do it, but, you know, we have certain rules and regulations. So it is difficult to understand.
June, we only have 20 seconds left here. Help us understand how you're going to cover this tonight on Bloomberg Law.
I'm talking to one of the foremost experts on Second Amendment rights, Adam Winkler, out of UCLA Law School. We're going to talk about all the different ramifications, what kind of laws might work and what don't.
All right. Looking forward to that. June Grasso, Bloomberg News legal analyst. Michael Bloomberg, the owner of Bloomberg LP, the parent company of Bloomberg News, is a founder and helps fund Every Town for Gun Safety. It's a nonprofit that advocates for gun violence prevention and other gun safety measures.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, it's the biggest crypto exchange in the world, and it's run by crypto's richest man, Changpeng Zhao. He's also known as CZ, if you've been paying attention to crypto over the last couple of years. Just a few months ago, he was worth $96 billion. Now he's down to about $11 billion. That's according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. Oh, yeah, he drives a Toyota minivan. Now, though, he's facing a looming regulatory crackdown in a brutal crypto winter. It is the subject of the cover of Bloomberg Business Week. It's available now on newsstands, on the Bloomberg Terminal, and at Bloomberg.com. The story written by Max Chafkin. He's a columnist at Bloomberg Businessweek. He's also the author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. Also joining us, the co-author of the story, Justina Lee. She's markets reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from London. Justina, I want to start with you. I know you spent a lot of time reporting out this story. It is just a fantastic profile of not just CZ and Binance, but also of the challenges that the company faces. And we learned a lot of new information here. I mean, if it even is fair to call it a company at this point, we'll get to that in a minute. But for people who aren't familiar with CZ, who is he?
Yes, CZ is the billionaire co-founder of the world's biggest crypto exchange. I think for a lot of people who haven't been paying attention to crypto might not really understand exactly how big Binance is. But, you know, in the past 24 hours, I think they usually say they processed $76 billion of transactions. And if you think about Coinbase as the exchange that most Americans are most familiar with, I mean, Binance is like, I think the last time I looked, about 40 times bigger than that. And that's because they have a lot of volumes in crypto derivatives.
Wow.
And that's because, you know, they're everywhere and they're really the retail traders' favorite crypto exchange.
And Max, you went to Dubai, you met the man. What was he like in person? Because he is sort of this mysterious but very prolific figure.
Well, yeah, and as Justine is saying, I mean, Binance itself is popular, and CZ, you know, has this kind of like cult following. The crypto heads really like the company, and they really like him. I mean, in person, he's very unassuming, right? He doesn't come off as a kind of what you would think of as a normal crypto billionaire. He drives a normal seeming car, or is driven, I probably should say, in a normal seeming car. You know, he's a slender, soft spoken, and so on. But of course, you know, this is all part of a pitch, and what Justine and I wrote about in this story is that Binance, basically after years of really kind of behaving, you know, very aggressively in terms of regulation, in terms of its approach to the law, is very much trying to strike a new note, which is a note of we are, CZ told me in Dubai, we're the stable guys. We're the adults in the room. And to people who follow this industry, I mean, that is a bold claim, to say the least.
Stable's a bit of a dirty word in crypto right now.
Yeah, and as Justina can speak to, I mean, this is not a company known for a lot of stability.
Okay, Justina, come on back in here. I'm not going to say the word because it's not allowed on radio, but I'll just say S coins, okay? S coins. People who know crypto know what I'm talking about here. What is Binance's relationship with these so-called S coins? And explain what they are.
Yeah, I mean, these S-coins, or we can call them altcoins, are basically these smaller cryptocurrencies that got really big in the ICO boom of 2017. And the relationship with Binance is that one thing they realized in 2017 was that people didn't just want to trade Bitcoin and Ethereum. They wanted to trade, you know, like hundreds of tokens that are, you know, that different people are pumping on the internet. And that was really how they first got big back then.
And so Binance is interesting because it's kind of jurisdiction free. Max, CZ is kind of jurisdiction free as well. How is that so? How is he able to do that?
Well, yeah. So the company was founded in China, but pretty quickly after they were founded, they basically went on the move. And what you have is this website, Binance.com, where most of the trading volume is, that doesn't really have a home. And there isn't a clear country. There isn't a clear jurisdiction. And that is basically both a feature and a bug. It's a bug because it's a regulatory vulnerability. You now have sort of regulators all over the world, and especially in the United States, scrutinizing this company very closely. But it's a feature in that it basically allowed them to offer all of these unlicensed financial products in enormous volumes, with very few repercussions. And so, that's why this company in a lot of ways embodies the crypto industry itself, because of course crypto is this, borderless, nationless idea, right? And then we have this borderless, nationless company. And what we're seeing now is the potential for those ideas to maybe run into, some of those old institutions that they were trying to displace.
Justina, as I mentioned at the top here, a lot of stuff you and Max uncovered new in this. And one part of that I want to get to is the ownership structure of different Binance arms throughout the world. Yesterday I reported on Binance US, the US arm, dropping its crypto trading fees. What is Binance US? How is it related to Binance? And what did you learn about this intricate web of different firms throughout the world?
Right. So Binance US started in 2019 because, US regulators wouldn't really have Binance in the country. And so Binance was like, we'll start this brand new entity that's going to be independent and it's going to be more compliant. For instance, they have far fewer S coins than the global exchange does. And so that's sort of like been, I would say, like quite a successful narrative so far. And that's sort of the way they've been operating, which is that they have this ambiguous entity, Binance.com. But, in some local jurisdictions, they might open a local company that might engage with regulators. And the question kind of behind all this is, who actually owns this cash cow? And it's quite mysterious because, as we've said, we don't know the parent company behind Binance.com. But if you look at the local entities and a very important company called Binance Capital Management in British Virgin Islands, which have done a lot of acquisitions for them, I mean, they're basically entirely owned by CZ, which kind of suggests that the company doesn't have any external shareholders. And it's quite interesting given that crypto has always been about decentralization, because at least in the financial sense, Binance is not decentralized at all.
All right. Well, this is the cover story of Bloomberg Business Week this week. It's available in new issue. It's on newsstands now. It's on the Bloomberg Terminal, and it's available at Bloomberg.com. Crypto's richest man faces regulatory crackdown. Brutal winter. The story written by Justina Lee. She is markets reporter for Bloomberg News. Also, Max Chafkin, columnist at Bloomberg Business Week. He's also the author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel, and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Juul's e-cigarettes have been ordered off the market here in the U.S. The FDA is saying in a statement today that Juul must stop selling and distributing the products, and that those that are on the market must be removed or risk enforcement action. The FDA, or according to FDA Commissioner Robert Califf, a rise in teenage use of vaping products had compelled the agency to conduct a thorough review of e-cigarettes. We've got a great voice on this. Lauren Etter is projects and investigations reporter for Bloomberg News. She's also the author of the fantastic book, Devil's Playbook, Big Tobacco, Juul, and the Addiction of a New Generation. Lauren joins us this afternoon on the phone from Los Angeles. Lauren, you've done so much reporting that has led up to this moment from the FDA. How did we get here?
So, yes, this has been a long time coming for Juul and really has been a wild card for the company. About 2 years ago, the company first submitted its application to receive marketing authorization from the FDA. and they were essentially banking on getting this. And the FDA, in a very surprised decision, ruled against the company and said the company didn't provide enough evidence to support its application and has, as you said, decided to take it off the market. This is a huge blow for Juul. It essentially could be the death penalty for the company. If the company has said that they're likely going to appeal the decision, but 95% of Juul's market is in the United States.
Wow.
Only 5% is overseas. So it effectively really takes the pulls the carpet out from underneath a company that just a few years ago was valued at $38 billion and was considered a unicorn in Silicon Valley. So this is a huge change of course for the company and is really devastating for the company.
So, Lauren, a potential death blow. But like you said, I mean, this is a long time coming for Juul. Has the company been preparing for this at all? Or, you know, you mentioned that they're going to appeal this, but how can they try to move past this, if at all?
Well, really, it's left to the agency and the courts at this position, at this point. The company has a few options at its hands right now. They're probably going to seek a stay so they can continue selling their product. They would likely potentially seek an appeal before the court. So really, they do have options before them, but they're not great options for the company that's looking at right now, as of today, not being able to sell any of their product in the United States.
Lauren, does this get kids to stop vaping? It's a big focus of what you wrote about in your book, The Devil's Playbook, Big Tobacco, Juul, and the Addiction of a New Generation. It was excerpted last year in Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. We had you on the program talking about it. And because there are other vaping companies out there.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Certainly, Juul is largely responsible for sparking this youth epidemic and nicotine use and nicotine addiction. But over the years, partly because Juul has taken measures to kind of pull back in its social media marketing and its, it doesn't market on social media and removed all of the fruity dessert flavors. So a lot of the kids did indeed move to new products, and they moved to products like Puff Bar, and other new ones are popping up every single day. So it certainly does not remove the immediate threat to kids in terms of adopting a new nicotine addiction, and there are plenty of products out there for them. But it does take away the company that that made the original sin, if you will, by marketing its product to teens. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's hard not to think that the FDA is punishing the company for its role in creating the youth nicotine epidemic. So youth usage in nicotine products has gone down over the past few years, partly due to the pandemic. But there are host of products out there that are left on the market. And the problem of youth nicotine addiction is not going to go away anytime soon and is not going to be solved by removing Juul from the market.
Lauren, just in the 30 seconds that we have left with you, before the FDA stuff years ago, this was seen as a safer alternative to smoking. Is it in fact safer? So what does this mean for I guess my question is, what does this mean for people who do smoke?
Well, certainly, almost anything is safer than a cigarette. It's a pretty low bar. Cigarettes are known to be deadly and kill millions of people every single year. So, essentially, it does remove an alternative for smokers today. But as the FDA pointed out in its decision and its release, press release today, there are other products that the FDA has in fact authorized. So there are other products that smokers can go to. They just can't go to Juul.
All right. There you have it. Lauren Etter, projects and investigations reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from Los Angeles. She's the author of The Devil's Playbook, Big Tobacco, Juul, and the Addiction of a New Generation. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Well, here we go. Under 9 minutes, the close of trading on this Thursday afternoon. We're very pleased right now to be joined by Rebecca Corbin. She's founder and CEO of Corbin Advisors, an investor research advisory firm. She publishes quarterly research on investor sentiment and market trends. She joins us this afternoon on the phone from Farmington, Connecticut. Rebecca, how are you?
Hi, Tim. Doing great. Thank you for having me.
Okay, I'm glad you said you're doing great because, you know, I want you to do well and I want you to have good sentiment. And sentiment is what I'm focused on here because your research kind of says the opposite.
Well, you all have to take this into consideration of the bigger picture. And I agree. The sentiment from the investor base is not positive. It shouldn't be a surprise, however. We've been reporting downbeat sentiment since the third quarter of last year. Was really when inflation and supply chain spooked investors. They've been talking about it, by the way, since December of 2020. Mm. And so here we are. And it's a slow movie that we're watching that I'm afraid won't have a happy ending, but everybody is pretty understanding that it's not going to be positive. And then we'll spring back, Tim and Katie.
And, I mean, it's interesting. If you look at what's expected out of the upcoming earnings season, even though you have, like, this kind of horrible sentiment both in consumers, among companies, we're hearing a lot of warnings about supply chains and dollar strength taking a toll on margins. But still, it looks like analysts have yet to make deep cuts in forward earnings projections, at least on the S&P 500 broad benchmark level. Does that have to change?
No, I think analysts are typically more reactive to times like this when things are moving extremely fluidly. This is, you know, day by day, we are seeing more and more fuel added to the fire. Gas is very expensive. And so what we're seeing is uncertainty. Investors don't like uncertainty. We came out with earnings guidance. For the first time in 6 quarters, we saw a dichotomy of performance from companies, right? We've all been in this super cycle, this CapEx super cycle, very similar performance in terms of, you know, through COVID, through 2021. And it wasn't until last quarter where we started to see companies really break out, companies increasing guidance, companies maintaining guidance, companies lowering guidance, and specific sectors actually being impacted by the inflation very significantly, by housing prices, et cetera, and specifically the Fed's actions to tame inflation. And so we're going to continue to see that. And it's very uncertain with regard to which industries are going to be impacted and which companies are going to be impacted when it's been very clear for investors. And so our call is that it is going to be very choppy through the remainder of the year. And then when we get to January 2023, when companies have to reset the bar with expectations for that particular year, I'm hopeful that we'll have a lot more clarity, good or bad, with regard to where the economy is going to break. And the thing about investors is that they just need certainty. So even in a challenging economic backdrop, if they have certainty with regard to what to expect, the equity markets will decouple from the economic performance.
Rebecca, help us and our listeners understand how you come about this research, because you write in our notes that we got from our producer, Paul Brennan, that nobody you surveyed are expecting a raise in annual guidance. And I wonder how you get that research how you get that sentiment, and then how that's different from other quarters where you've conducted this research.
Absolutely. So for the past 14 years, and how I started my company was serving institutional investors every quarter heading into earnings season. We typically are serving about 80 to 100 investors globally. These are institutional investors, professional investors around the world. And we have a series of questions that we pose to them with regard to earnings, guidance, the economy, regions that they're expecting. By the way, it's available on our website, CorbinAdvisors.com, under our research. It's free to the public. We do this because we feel it's a positive thing to do to help corporations understand what the sentiment is for them to prepare, as well as investors to help them have companies that are acting in best practice standards. And so we will be publishing our research, which I'm giving you a sneak peek of today, on July 14th. Investors are draconian. They are way ahead of where corporate realities are, okay? And we don't know how many quarters ahead, but when we have conducted research ahead of cycle changes, recessions, et cetera, it can be anywhere from 12 to 36 months in advance of investors feeling very concerned and skeptical and deep angst around what they believe is going to happen. I can tell you that companies are still seeing growth. We still will have companies that report very strong case in terms of organic growth and EPS. Cash flow is likely to come under pressure, but investors cannot fathom and really have built a wall of perception around the bottom, which in order for them to get over that, you know, unfortunately, we have to deliver on that. And we're not, companies are not prepared to deliver on that because that's not what they're seeing. So we're in this very choppy water where investors are predicting things to come, and you and I do not have a crystal ball, but none of the data looks positive, and it does look like we're heading in that recessionary environment period. But it is taking some time for that to have an impact on corporate earnings and corporate performance, right, and we are still going to see strength.
Rebecca, what surprised you about this latest round of research and your findings?
I think it's very interesting how draconian investors are with regard to, you know, hearing companies come out and say they still are seeing strong demand, they still have record backlogs. Now, let me be clear. Companies are going to come out. They have become more cautious. Fourth quarter, they were more cautious from third quarter. For sure, in the first quarter, they were more cautious than the fourth quarter. And we're going to continue on that trend, which is fueling the angst of investors,
right,
which is why January 23, you know, is going to be that time where we can reset these expectations. But it's a very interesting slow roll. And what I'm very fascinated around,
right,
is, you know, how companies are going to change their capital deployment strategies, because we've been on a very serious, massive CapEx program, and that's really what's been fueling the economy. And I'm interested to see if companies pull that
right
back. I'm also interested to see,
Rebecca,
how many companies are announcing layoffs.
We unfortunately have to run one of those layoffs from Netflix today, 300 people, according to Variety. Rebecca Corbin, founder and CEO of Corbin Advisors, joining us from Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability, This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.